is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. One after another, in rapid succession, a string of lawmakers stood on the House floor and made their arguments.
Madam Speaker, I rise in support of impeaching again the worst president in the history of the United States.
Donald Trump is a living, breathing, impeachable offense.
We should be focused on bringing the nation together. Instead, Democrats are going to impeach the president for a second time, one week before he leaves office. Why?
The president took an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Last week, there was a domestic threat at the door of the Capitol, and he did nothing to stop it.
As the third-ranking Republican in this chamber put it, he summoned the mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack.
He needed to say only two words to end the violence. I concede.
I call bullcrap when I hear the Democrats demanding unity. Sadly, they are only unified in hate.
The mob could have blown the building up. They could have killed us all.
Following that debate, the U.S. House of Representatives voted once again to impeach the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. It makes him the only U.S. president to be impeached twice. So what happens next? Joining me to help answer this question is Mary McCord. She served as the acting assistant attorney general for national security at the Department of Justice. She's currently the legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown University Law Center. Mary, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you for having me, Jen.
Also with us, Claudia Grisales, an NPR congressional reporter. Claudia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Deepak Gupta, the founding principal of Gupta Wessler Law Firm in D.C. He's a constitutional lawyer. He recently published an opinion piece in the New York Times titled, "Impeachment Isn't the Only Option Against Trump." Deepak, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
So I want to start with you, Deepak. The Constitution says the president can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. How is the clause high crimes and misdemeanors typically interpreted?
Well, we had a whole debate about this last year, and every time there's an impeachment, there's a debate, and you have constitutional law professors come before the Congress and testify. And the reality is that this is one of those questions that's sort of partially a legal question, but partially a political question. When people hear the term high crimes or misdemeanors, they often think that it means a very serious crime. And you did hear some people argue in the last impeachment that you needed a crime to impeach. That's most constitutional scholars regard that as a pretty serious mistake. The term high crimes or misdemeanors means an abuse of the office. High refers to the public nature of the offense, that it is an abuse of trust, and so it doesn't have to be an offense that violates some existing criminal statute, but it has to be a very serious offense that offends the constitutional order, and means that this is not a person who can be permitted to hold office.
Claudia, what were the main arguments Democrats and Republicans were making yesterday? We heard a taste of it just a moment ago.
Yes, they were describing those horrific scenes that we saw at the Capitol last week, just recounting their own experiences, their own fears, those moments. And they said, ultimately, that accountability for this deadly insurrection should be held. It should be held for the president. President Trump must face consequences for his actions at the rally before the attack and his buildup before then through tweets and other statements he made, spreading this disinformation that the election results could somehow be overturned. The actual article of impeachment is just 4 pages, but it charges Trump with gravely endangering the country and interfering with a peaceful transfer of power, and that he remains a threat to national security. It also notes that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits any person who's engaged in an insurrection from holding office again. So this is part of an argument that we're going to see going forward as well.
Now, Mary, incitement of insurrection is also a charge of sedition. Does this carry additional legal troubles for the president outside of impeachment?
Well, I mean, certainly, as we've been discussing, there's various forms of accountability, and one could be through criminal liability. Certainly, there is a predicate for an investigation into President Trump's seeming incitement to insurrection, and I've actually written about this. There's, you know, when you put together all of the false statements that he's made, even before the election, but certainly since the election, and his calling on his followers to come to Washington last January 6th, and his, you know, telling them to fight like hell, you know, and march down the street to the Capitol, all of these things together are a predicate of facts that would be certainly enough to launch a criminal investigation, which would further try to probe his intent. And I would note that the federal crime of insurrection carries with it a penalty of a prohibition on a person from holding any federal office, which I think is really part of the execution of that 14th Amendment Section 3 the provision within that section of the Constitution that says that anyone who engages in insurrection shall not be able to hold office again.
Now, Claudia, the process moves to the Senate from here, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said yesterday he won't reconvene the chamber until January 19th. Do we have a sense of a timeline for a Senate trial yet?
McConnell said that they are on this delay. The Senate is essentially in limbo. That's what's slowing all of this down, with the Georgia Senate runoff races putting control of that chamber into Democrats' hands. It's going to take some time for Georgia to certify those results and for the Senate to reconvene under Democratic control. So McConnell is acknowledging there that they're in limbo. We really shouldn't start a Senate trial at this time under Republican control. And so it really looks like this may not get going, perhaps until the first few days of a Biden administration. And from there, it could very well mimic the first Senate impeachment trial that we saw for President Trump, very tightly coordinated in terms of daily meetings, no speaking in the chamber at certain times for members, no cell phones. We could see all of that repeated over several weeks' time once again, perhaps as soon as later this month.
Well, we got this question from Barron, who asks, can your guests clarify why there's this focus on Mitch McConnell's impeachment vote after the Senate reconvenes? Won't there be a 50-50 split by then with Democratic Chuck Schumer and not McConnell as the Senate Majority Leader and Vice President Harris as the tiebreaker? Claudia, explain why this 50-50 split in the Senate, it's not enough to ensure a conviction for President Trump.
Exactly. They're going to need a large majority of the chamber to vote for his conviction. So two-thirds vote in that chamber. So those 50 votes will not cut it. They're going to need Republicans. Democrats will need Republicans to come on board. And with recent reports that McConnell could be considering possibly joining Democrats to vote for conviction, that could really sway a large share of his caucus, of his party, to join Democrats and perhaps give them the votes that they need to get the president convicted.
So that's the dynamic in the Senate. But 10 Republicans voted for impeachment in the House. Were you surprised by any of the members who broke ranks?
Yes, definitely. We had heard some of these Republican members come out in the earlier day saying that they would vote for impeachment just ahead of the vote yesterday. That includes Liz Cheney of Wyoming. This is the number three Republican in the House. And that gave some cover for other Republicans to join her. And that includes Representative Tom Rice of South Carolina. He's in a district that is pretty pro-Trump. And I was in the chamber when those votes were coming in. And repeatedly, we were hearing from our colleagues that must be a mistake. Perhaps he made an error in the vote. We kept watching his vote to see if it would change. But no, a few moments after that vote was tallied, he said he had backed this president through thick and thin for years. He campaigned for him. He voted for him twice. But this utter failure that we saw last week was inexcusable. So that's one of the surprises. Another surprise was Representative Anthony Gonzalez from Ohio. That was one name we were not expecting. He had not issued a statement ahead of the vote, so that was a bit of surprise too. And then we have a new member from Michigan. This is Peter Mayer. He's a freshman. He took Justin Amash's seat. This is the former Republican who became an independent in 2019. He voted for impeachment. Amash did, but we didn't know if the gentleman who won his seat this past year would do the same, and he did. He has been very vocal about the concerns about what he saw last week, and it was surprising to see this freshman take that jump to vote for impeachment.
And that's Peter Mayer of Michigan. Claudia, so there's some dynamics playing out among Republicans, but I wonder about the tensions among Democrats as Joe Biden prepares to be inaugurated as the next president of the United States, and concerns around his agenda and moving forward with a Senate trial.
Yeah, we are hearing a theme from Democrats. We're hearing they can walk and chew gum at the same time. Biden has said perhaps they could divvy up the days, half for the impeachment trial in the Senate, half devoted to his agenda, his nominees, confirming those folks. And I've heard that repeatedly from Democrats as well. I talked to Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia this week, and he said the same. He doesn't think that this will overtake, eclipse his agenda. Instead, he thinks that both tracks can be running at the same time.
We're talking to NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Also with us, Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at the Georgetown University Law Center, and constitutional lawyer Deepak Gupta. I'm Jen White. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing the second impeachment of President Trump with Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at the Georgetown University Law Center, NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, constitutional lawyer Deepak Gupta, and with you. Valencia emails, I'm a proud 20-year retired Navy veteran, and I think Trump should be impeached whether he is the president or not. Trump should be put in jail for treason, among other crimes against this nation and its people. What questions do you have about impeachment? Do you think it's a good idea, or do you think there are other smarter ways to hold the president accountable for his actions? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Deepak, we got this email from Lorraine who says, my major concern is that Trump never runs for office again. Are there any ways that can be prevented short of being found guilty by the Senate? You recently wrote in the New York Times that Congress can use the 14th Amendment to stop Trump from holding office again. Explain how that would work.
Sure. And I do want to emphasize that I think impeachment should be pursued. The proposal I've made is an alternative, and you could think of it as a kind of plan B in the event that the Senate fails to convict. And it also has a broader reach. So Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is a little known provision of the Constitution that was added after the Civil War as part of the Reconstruction Amendments. And the principal focus that the drafters had was trying to make sure that people who had facilitated the secession and fought for the Confederacy would not rejoin the federal government and potentially threaten the constitutional order again. And so what Section 3 says is anyone who has served under the United States or a state government and has taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or a member of a state legislature to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, if they then betray that oath by engaging in an insurrection or rebellion against the Constitution, they are disqualified from holding office again. And it's remarkable how much that provision of the Constitution speaks to this moment. It uses the language insurrection. It is about someone who has taken their oath and betrayed that oath, and it's specifically concerned with this question that your listener asked, which is, can such a person be disqualified from holding office in the future? So it's true, disqualification from office is one of the remedies that Congress can vote for in an impeachment process, but even separate from impeachment, the Constitution already has a provision about disqualification for insurrection. And the proposal I've made is that Congress should pursue legislation to put that provision into effect.
How often has this provision been used?
Not very much. There was a flurry of activity right after the Civil War, as you can imagine, because there were Confederates who wanted to serve in the government, and there was a very famous treason trial for Jefferson Davis. But just as the Reconstruction didn't live up to its full promise, there was a kind of backlash against Reconstruction, there was also a backlash against the full comprehensive use of this amendment. And ultimately, the legislation that Congress had passed to enforce the amendment, the first Ku Klux Klan, part of the first Ku Klux Klan Act, that enforcement legislation was repealed, and this became not a dead letter, but just a kind of forgotten part of the Constitution. There's only one time in the early 20th century it was misused against a socialist member of Congress from Wisconsin. So there's really not a lot of history, but the history that we have does tell us what the words insurrection or rebellion mean. And I do think they provide a roadmap that Congress can follow if it wants to pursue legislation to enforce this provision.
Mary, who else can be held liable for the insurrection at the Capitol? Could this extend to Trump's lawyers like Rudy Giuliani?
I think it could. I mean, we're already seeing, on a daily basis, more and more of the individuals who actually physically participated in the insurrection as they are identified through video and photographs and their own social media posting. You know, they're being charged with a whole variety of federal crimes. I think the investigation will proceed from there, and I'm sure it is proceeding from there. The U.S. attorney, the acting U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., has said as much, and so has the FBI, and they have a task force now specifically looking at conspiracy and sedition. So that could be others. I already mentioned the president for one, but also his attorneys and potentially others within his inner circle who may have been involved in either organizing any of these rallies, knowing that there was an intention to act violently and potentially engage in some sort of assault on the Capitol that would stop the voting from taking place. You know, that is the day that the joint session of Congress met to open up the electoral votes submitted by the states and officially certify Joe Biden the winner. And so, you know, what did others know, those who weren't the ones participating in the physical attack, but those who were talking about it in public speeches, tweeting about it, writing about it and encouraging it? What did they know about the intent of some to commit acts of violence when they were encouraging this? All of that would be important. Also, other connections. Who were people in contact with? People, the president and people in his circle. Were they in contact with any of those who actually took part in the insurrection? Were they providing any funding to any of those people, their businesses, their foundation? There's lots of ways that investigators, when you investigate crimes, look for connections that will help to show a conspiracy and will also help to show intent. Because, of course, when it's not the person on the ground, or on the scaling the walls of the Capitol, then you have to really be able to show knowledge and intent.
We got this question from Jay, who asks, we discussed earlier that 50 votes plus the vice president won't be enough to convict in an impeachment trial. But doesn't the balance toward a Democratic majority change how the trial proceeds a second time? Last year's impeachment trial had the Republicans in control of the Senate, which meant Republicans set the rules, including whether witnesses and documents were even allowed as evidence. What can Democrats do now that they couldn't last year? Claudia, I'll give that question to you.
Yes, it's going to give Democrats control of the clock in terms of how the floor is run during an impeachment trial. And yes, that's a great point. In terms of witnesses, that was a very large, dramatic vote and debate over whether witnesses should be allowed. And Republicans did not go for that. We could easily see something like that expand out even more. At the other side of that, however, is that Democrats are also balancing Biden's new agenda. So how much time do they want to take up going through the buildup to the insurrection and Trump's role in all that? So that also has to be weighed. But that all said, Democrats are now in the driver's seat on how this impeachment trial is going to look and what they will cover. So yes, it's going to have a significant impact on what we see in the coming weeks.
But Claudia, how complicated does this get when witnesses for this trial, maybe members of Congress, and some of the people who are alleged bad actors are also members of Congress?
I think very complicated. That's going to be a really difficult question that will come before them. And yes, it could be members of Congress. We're talking about members of the House, for example, that attended this rally, that spoke to this mob before they attacked the Capitol. What was their role? So it's very possible that Democrats could look at these members as potential witnesses that they have to hear from.
Mary, talk about the burden of proof here. I mean, incitement of insurrection. How do lawmakers prove that?
Well, you know, we do have, there are differences between burden of proof in an impeachment trial in the Senate and a burden of proof in a court of law, right? In a court of law, it's beyond a reasonable doubt, and it's a jury of 12 has to be unanimous. So, but I think that this will look very different if this trial takes place than the trial a year ago, for example. I think, Americans and the world watched in real time this insurrection take place. A year ago, we had complicated testimony about phone calls and interactions with people in a foreign government, about connections and attempts to seek favors from people in a foreign government. Things that were, I think, more complicated for people to understand at a trial. Now, again, I'm suggesting the American people understand, and they don't get a chance to vote, of course, in the Senate in an impeachment trial. But the senators are impacted, and appropriately so, by what their constituents think about this. And I think this the proof in this trial will be easier, I think, in many ways, because we saw what was happening, and we heard the president's words, we saw his tweets, we saw, you can put together social media encouraging violence and insurrection, and even things as, you know, extreme as civil war, and repeatedly stop the steal, stop the steal, stop the steal. You can create a timeline where that call is being made by his most extreme followers, and he's responding to it with, you must fight, we will never concede, we will never give up. And you can put those things together, and a reasonable person would have to understand, particularly a reasonable person that knows the microphone, the bully pulpit that the president has, would have to understand how his words would be interpreted by his followers. So I think that just in terms of the evidence here, this is a more straightforward case than a year ago. And I think that's what we'll see when it does get to trial in the Senate.
That's Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown University Law Center. Also with us, NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales and constitutional lawyer Deepak Gupta. We got this email from Robert, who says, what I want is for Trump to receive no pension and be prevented from holding office. Deepak, what are some of the other ways President Trump could be held accountable here?
Well, so there is a former President's Act that gives the president a pension and a variety of privileges after office. And if the president is convicted in the impeachment, he would lose those privileges. But I also think, it is important that there be a backstop, as I was saying earlier, in case we don't reach the 2/3 vote in impeachment, that there be a process for ensuring that the president cannot stand for office again, and also that other people besides the president who may have been involved may have incited or directed or participated in this insurrection, that there are consequences for those people as well. One concern I have about the impeachment is that the trial is going to, it could be delayed somewhat, but the trial is probably going to have to happen relatively soon, and it's only going to be about Trump. And we're going to have a lot of investigation. Mary has mentioned the FBI's investigation. I think there will have to be a congressional investigation. Perhaps there will be a commission formed, and we'll get a kind of 9/11 commission-style report that's a very comprehensive look at everything that happened, but that may take quite some time. And I think what we'll find out, and the facts are already emerging, is that there was a lot of orchestration of what happened here. This was not a random event. It was funded and organized by some entities that would surprise us in terms of their ties to the political establishment, that there may have been actual phone calls with the White House directing or coordinating all of this. And my fear is just that the timeline of the impeachment process is not going to reveal all of that. It takes time for the full nature of the facts to come out. And so the proposal that I've made that I mentioned earlier for legislation would allow the consequences for all of this to play out in the future through a procedure in court. And so, for example, let's imagine that there's someone who participated in this insurrection who was a former law enforcement official or military official who swore an oath to defend the Constitution. They go back to their home state and they run for Congress as a hero of the insurrection. And they say, send me to Congress because I participated in this insurrection. That's not an unthinkable hypothetical. Or, it turns out that certain members of Congress really were directly involved. The impeachment of Donald Trump is not going to create direct consequences for those people. And their conduct may not rise to the level of a criminal act that can be successfully prosecuted. So the virtue of having legislation that creates a process for disqualification is that we can ensure that this constitutional mandate about disqualification is actually enforced.
Mary, the FBI warned of violence, or the possibility of violence between now and Inauguration Day. How would you describe the current risk of another attack?
So it's been very interesting to watch, Jen, the fallout from January 6th. And I will tell you, it reminds me very much of the fallout after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August of 2017. In the immediate aftermath, that night and the next day, the rioters in Charlottesville, just like the insurrectionists in Washington, D.C., were elated and proud of themselves. And they thought they had done something big and important. And then in the ensuing days, as sort of universal condemnation rained down upon them, they started infighting. They started pointing fingers. They started having dissension about strategy. That happened, after the Unite the Right. Some of the organizations that had participated, then later distanced themselves from the organizers. Some of those organizations imploded and got rid of their leadership. And we're seeing similar things in sort of the online rhetoric now. We're seeing differences among strategy, whether that had been a good idea or not. We're seeing people now saying, don't go to any of the upcoming planned rallies, which include what had been planned to be an armed assault on state capitals in all 50 states on Sunday, and then a sort of a last stand protest in D.C. on Inauguration Day, the 20th. We're seeing now some people saying, don't go, partly because, we didn't denounce violence, but we're seeing others say, don't go because this is a trap. It's a law enforcement trap to catch you. And others, even more extreme, saying, don't go because this is actually an Antifa trap. They're actually trying to orchestrate these rallies.
Mary, hold that thought for a moment. We've got to go to a break, but I want to pick up a conversation. We're here with Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at the Georgetown University Law Center, NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, and constitutional lawyer Deepak Gupta. I'm Jen White. We'll be back in a moment. Let's get back to impeachment with Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown University Law School. Also with us, NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales and constitutional lawyer Deepak Gupta. Mary, I want you to quickly pick up your thought there. You're talking about infighting among far-right groups that's starting to emerge online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it does make it very difficult for state and local and federal officials to know exactly what to expect. Like I said, there are different groups and individuals who are, you know, having differences of opinion about the best strategy going forward. I will say, though, that even though there are some calls to not participate in rallies on the 17th and on the 20th, sometimes, you know, those that are even the most extreme among them see that almost as a betrayal and take it upon themselves to think, well, if the others aren't going to go, then I need to do something even more extreme. So I don't want to terrify people who are listening to this, but I think the point here is that things are very much in flux, and so the FBI is doing the right thing by helping state and local officials and federal officials to prepare for the possibility of violence, to make sure that they are not caught off guard, make sure that they prepare sufficiently so that they can protect public safety. And also, you know, always I think in law enforcement and in public safety, preparing for the worst and hoping for the best is what, you know, I've kind of practiced during my own time in government, and I think that's very much warranted here. I would add one more point, which is that there's been a lot of deplatforming since last week. You know, major platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Google, YouTube, you know, have really taken down a lot of the different services, platforms that extremists use to plot and plan, and also some of them themselves, because they are worried about law enforcement investigations, have taken to encrypted direct messaging apps. So we have a little bit more of a blind spot, law enforcement does, in exactly the detailed planning that might be taking place. So for all of these reasons, I think it's very difficult right now to predict exactly what is going to happen, but we do know that there are people who feel like this is a time to double down, and so we do have to be vigilant and take care, and people should really consider, you know, maybe not going out to their state capitals on January 17th and maybe watching the inauguration, you know, on their television.
I want to quickly move through some of the questions we're getting in. Jane asks, I've read that a president cannot pardon anyone during the time between impeachment by the House and conviction by the Senate. Can you clarify this? Deepak, I'll come to you.
Well, the president can pardon people until his time in office is up. So he can pardon people, and presumably will do so. He's been telegraphing that for a while, and reports are that he's been asking people in the White House, you know, whether they would like pardons, and asking associates whether they'd like pardons. I think that the big debate has been about whether the president can pardon himself. And that has never happened before in American history. And I think, you know, constitutional scholars have debated that, but we really don't know what the courts would say, or even whether the courts would say that is a question that they can hear. There's an argument that it's not even really a pardon when the pardon is the president pardoning himself. It would be an awkward document. He'd have to write it in the third person. The Constitution speaks about pardoning of offenses against the United States. The idea is that the president is, you know, granting some clemency to a person to show mercy. So it really isn't a pardon in the way that anyone has thought of a pardon through Anglo-American legal history. Mm-hmm. And there's really an open question about whether if he tries that, it would be enforced. I think what your viewer may be referring to is that a pardon cannot cover impeachment. So, you know, the president can't just circumvent the impeachment process by attempting to pardon himself for the very thing he's convicted of in the impeachment.
Well, another question here from Cindy, who says, does Section 3 of the 14th Amendment have retroactive powers? That is, if it is invoked by Congress under the Biden administration, does it nullify any actions made by Trump, like pardons, et cetera, after the January 6th insurrection and before his departure on the 26th? Very briefly, Deepak, what can you tell us about that?
Well, the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is an important and powerful provision, but the only effect of it is to disqualify someone who's covered from serving in office again. So it can't nullify actions taken by the president. But it can cover actions that occurred before Congress legislates. So it can cover the insurrection that just occurred.
Claudia, many of us never thought we'd see thousands of National Guardsmen actively patrolling the U.S. Capitol. Can you describe the mood at the Capitol right now? How are people feeling?
Yeah, that was a really, really dramatic shift in terms of what we saw happen with security as of yesterday. We had seen a buildup after last week, after the insurrection of security, but we saw this perimeter expanded around the Capitol. It's very difficult to get into the area now, and you have to go through several layers now of security checks to get inside the building. And it is blanketed with, of course, U.S. Capitol Police officers, but as you mentioned, thousands of members of the National Guard. And just yesterday alone, just seeing hundreds of these members inside the Capitol Visitor Center. That's where they were kind of taking their breaks. They were sleeping overnight. They're basically living there. I ran into a few members of the Guard, and they were telling me we've been here for about a week, and they were looking for food, and they're just making it their new home. So in terms of how that impacts the mood, there's a lot of gratitude to have these members here of the Guard at the Capitol. But at the same time, people are nervous. They're on edge that this is the kind of protection we need now at the Capitol. This is the layers of security we need now in the wake of this insurrection. And just a bit on pins and needles, if something like this could be attempted again. And folks are, you know, on the edge here, watching for that.
Well, Representative Peter Meyer of Michigan, he was one of the Republicans who voted to impeach, told Haley Jackson on MSNBC that he's buying body armor and altering his daily routines because his life is in danger. How are individual lawmakers feeling about their safety and security right now after the insurrection?
We're seeing a wide range of reactions. They put new screeners outside of the House chamber, for example. I had never seen that before, and members are having to pass through those. Some Republicans were really upset about it. They were just speeding through or trying to skip the screenings yesterday after having to go through that, and that's raised some objections from Republicans and Democrats are trying to send this message that this is needed. In terms of, for example, the bulletproof vest, there was a memo sent out this week by a House panel to members, just reminding them of their reimbursable expenses. And unfortunately, these vests are reimbursable. This came up after the shooting at the baseball field in Washington, D.C. in 2017. This became a concern. So members have visited this issue before. It's just very heightened now in terms of what they're doing. They're all taking different actions to increase their security. Some are being confronted at airports. They're just having to take additional steps and considerations now like they never have before to ensure their safety.
We're talking to NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, constitutional lawyer Deepak Gupta, and Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown University Law Center. And we should say both the Washington Post and NBC are now reporting that the entire National Mall will close on Inauguration Day. There will be no public access. I'm going to read a couple of other comments we've gotten here. Jill tweets, no American should wish for impeachment to become an easy tool to remove a president they simply don't like. Trump's impeachments were not made lightly. He spent 4 years undermining the Constitution, our rule of law, and now fomenting sedition. What is impeachment for, if not that? But Jeff writes on Facebook, the president is most certainly not guilty of incitement, reason being advocacy versus incitement. The president's speech calling for peaceful, patriotic protest to let your voices be heard falls under protected political speech known as advocacy. Deepak, your response to that?
Well, we're certainly going to hear this argument from the president's defenders in the impeachment trial. And, you know, they have a point to an extent, which is that we don't want a system. We have a First Amendment. It's the first amendment for a reason. It's important that we preserve protection for political speech. And, you know, you can imagine a public official speaking at a rally for racial justice who talks to the crowd, riles them up, and does not intend to cause violence, but the crowd engages in violence. So there's something to that argument in our constitutional values and traditions. But the president here, was not just making a speech to a peaceful crowd. He was telling them to fight like hell. This followed months of undermining the election and the integrity of our democracy, and people were sent there to obstruct a constitutional process, the counting of the electoral votes, and the peaceful transition of power. And, you know, as the facts come out, I think it's going to become clearer and clearer that the president sent these people to the Capitol, that this was more than just a peaceful speech. It was incitement to insurrection, which is a crime under the federal code, but is also, a violation of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and cannot be tolerated. We've never had anything remotely like this in American history, where a violent mob has disrupted. We can no longer say we had a peaceful transition of power. Right? There was bloodshed at the Capitol. The situation was so grave that the authorities had to call in for help from the National Guard to quell the violence. And those who incited this bear responsibility. So I think we'll hear that argument, but I don't think it will be very successful.
Well, Democrats are calling on various GOP lawmakers to resign over their actions during the last week. That list includes Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert. She's repeated the lie that Democrats rigged the election. And during the insurrection, she tweeted House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had been removed from the House floor. Mary, there are two tweets in question here. The first is, quote, we were locked in the House chambers. The second is, quote, the Speaker has been removed from the chamber. How much does the intent behind her tweets matter here? Because some people are alleging she's giving direction to the insurrectionists, and she's saying that wasn't what I was doing.
Right. So if we're talking about, criminal liability, intent is critical. I mean, the law, with very few exceptions, doesn't impose strict liability. It requires mens rea, which is an intent to actually commit or to further a crime or to aid and abet or facilitate it or, in this case, incite it. And I think an investigation, again, into who she was communicating with, besides the tweets, obviously, what she knew was happening while it was happening, what she knew was planned to happening, in the lead up to January 6th, all of that will be important. But that said, criminal liability is a higher burden of proof, a higher standard than anything that would be required to potentially is a higher burden of proof that anything would be required to take political remedies. So things like not seating her on committees, things like that. There are political remedies that could be instituted, including also obviously encouraging her to resign, which is not necessarily a remedy. It's an encouraging her to resign. And, you know, there's impeachment of for elected officials such as herself as a remedy as well, which again does not have the same standard of proof as, or burden as a criminal prosecution would. So I think she and others will be investigated and should be investigated. And regardless of the outcome of a criminal investigation, they certainly are deserving of sanction and approbation by their fellow colleagues on Capitol Hill.
Well, let's wrap on this email from Bruce, who says, COVID and insurrection, cancel the inauguration party and get to work. Claudia, President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration is less than a week away. It's going to look much different than what we've seen in the past. In about 30, 45 seconds here, what do we know about what to expect next week?
I think we got a preview yesterday in terms of how the Capitol looked and the presence of security there and the scaled down operations. Yes, considering the pandemic, as well as now these really hefty security concerns, it's going to be a very scaled back program and very limited in terms of who'll be able to access that Capitol building that day.
That's NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Also with us, Mary McCord, legal director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. She's a visiting professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. She's also a former acting assistant attorney general of national security at the Department of Justice and constitutional law expert Deepak Gupta. He's founding principal of Gupta Wessler Law Firm in D.C. Thanks to you all for being here today. Remember to subscribe to the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and stories every day, and you can listen whenever you'd like. Get it wherever you find your podcasts. Today's producer was James Morrison. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen Moyt. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.